From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, behind the scenes at the Supreme Court, we talk with CNN legal analyst and New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin. In his new book, The Nine, he describes a conservative counter-revolution underway in the court. And he writes about recent decisions and the justices who made them. In his chapter on the 2000 election and Bush v. Gore, he shares some new revealing stories, including that David Souter considered resigning after the decision. Also, a New York Times business reporter who was held hostage in a toy factory in China while trying to report on toys that had been recalled because of lead paint. We talk with David Barboza about his adventure and about the recalls of Chinese products. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the moderating centrist voice of Sandra Day O'Connor gone from the Supreme Court, a conservative counter-revolution that had been stymied for 20 years has now begun. So says Jeffrey Toobin in his new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. His book is about how this counter-revolution developed. It's also a behind-the-scenes look at the court, its recent decisions, and the personalities of the justices behind them. The Nine is based on interviews with justices and their law clerks that were given on a not-for-attribution basis. Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. One chapter of his new book revisits the decision Bush v. Gore, which he wrote about in a best-selling book. In that decision, the Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount in the contested 2000 presidential election and allowed the Florida certification of Bush's victory to stand. This put Bush over the top in electoral votes, making him president. In Toobin's new book, he comes up with some new, revealing stories about that decision. Isn't this the decision that Supreme Court justices are most uncomfortable talking about?
I think they all know that in the second paragraph of their obituaries will be how they voted in Bush v. Gore. That defined them. And what particularly bothered them about the case is that it was so nakedly political. The justices have a conception of themselves that is separate from politics. I mean, they are realistic, they are practical people, but they also try to portray themselves, even to themselves, as apart from politics. And this was so political and so sort of grotesquely partisan that that's what really makes them uncomfortable about it.
Now, you write a lot about Sandra Day O'Connor throughout your book. She figures, of course, prominently in the Bush v. Gore chapter. You say that she had her mind made up about Bush v. Gore. She thought George W. Bush should win the case as well as the election. Why?
Well, Sandra O'Connor is a Republican, and proudly so. She was the majority leader of the Arizona Senate. She identifies with Republicans. She particularly liked the elder President Bush and his wife, Barbara. Those were her kind of Republicans. And on election night, she was and her husband were unusually open about their hope for President Bush to win the election. Once the case got into the Supreme Court, the complaints of the Democrats were exactly the kind of thing that O'Connor hated. She thought that the case was about voters who had made mistakes, who were incompetent, who were complaining and making excuses, just the kind of thing that O'Connor, the old ranch hand from Arizona, just didn't like to hear. So the combination of her predilection for the Bush family and the kind of complaints the Democrats were making really turned O'Connor off. And I believe that the Democrats never really had a chance to get her vote in this case.
But you think that she later regretted her decision and that she became disillusioned about the Republican Party and the presidency of George W. Bush.
See, this is what I really learned in writing my book. This is the surprise to me, is the effect the decision had on O'Connor. Because the reaction to Bush v. Gore was so extreme and so angry that it really challenged O'Connor's conception of herself as someone who was fair and nonpartisan and someone who was a Supreme Court justice universally respected, and she was really taken aback by that. You combine that reaction with what George Bush's presidency turned out to be, something very different from what O'Connor thought it would be, a very conservative presidency. She did not like John Ashcroft, who was the President Bush's first attorney general. Justice O'Connor is not an evangelical Christian right Republican. She is an old school country club Republican. And as the new President Bush became more and more conservative, especially when it came to civil liberties after 9/11, O'Connor rebelled, in part because she was worried about her historical reputation in light of Bush v. Gore, and in part because she simply did not like the direction the Bush administration was going.
What's a decision in which you think her opinion was a rebellion against President Bush?
Well, I think the Guantanamo Bay cases were a direct repudiation of President Bush. I mean, there's this extraordinary moment in the court where the argument of the first Guantanamo Bay cases takes place in 2003 in the spring. And Justice Ginsburg asks a question, and she says in the oral argument to Paul Clement, who was then the Deputy Solicitor General, you know, what if the president decided to authorize torture? I mean, do you think he could do that? And Paul Clement gets rather indignant and says, well, our president would never do such a thing. That very night, the night of the oral argument in the Guantanamo Bay cases, is the night that 60 Minutes 2 broadcast the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse story for the first time. And that's when the court really rebels against the Bush administration. And it's O'Connor who really lectures the Bush administration in her opinion in that case, where she says, you know, in times of national crises, that's when we have to stand strongest for civil liberties. And she cites the Korematsu case, one of the darkest moments in the history of the Supreme Court, which approved the exclusion of the Japanese from the West Coast during World War II. And she essentially saw the Bush administration as repeating those sorts of mistakes. And that case was an extraordinary public rebuke of the Bush administration, and the court was led by its ever-present swing justice, O'Connor.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and we're talking about his new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Now, let's get back to Bush v. Gore. You write a little bit about Justice Kennedy's equal protection argument in that case and why Ruth Bader Ginsburg was so outraged by it. Would you describe his equal protection argument and why Ginsburg was so outraged?
Well, what's interesting about, you know, reconstructing Bush v. Gore is that even though the Supreme Court was only involved in 21 of the 36 days of the fight after the election of 2000, a lot happened. There were two different Supreme Court arguments and decisions, and the Bush team basically, almost as a throwaway in the beginning of this, the legal fight, said, "Well, you know, it's a violation of the of Bush's rights under the Equal Protection Clause that the votes will be counted one way in one county and one way in another county." Now, this argument was almost laughable in the beginning because this Supreme Court, the more conservative Rehnquist Court, had been contracting the Equal Protection Clause, had been narrowing the rights that could be asserted, usually by racial minorities. And the idea that George Bush could be a victim of equal protection seemed almost preposterous, even to the Bush lawyers themselves. But Anthony Kennedy, in the oral argument of Bush v. Gore, embraced it and wound up writing part of the decision, that part of the decision saying that Bush's rights had been discriminated against. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had devoted her career to the Equal Protection Clause. She had been the leading lawyer for women who had been aggrieved by gender discrimination. She knew the Equal Protection Clause better than any of the other justices on the court. And the idea that George W. Bush would be the beneficiary of this clause that was being narrowed for women, for blacks, made her enraged. But Kennedy had the votes, and that's the decision. What almost made it worse for the dissenters was perhaps the most notorious sentence in Bush v. Gore, because at the last minute, the majority worried about creating all sorts of new rights and new lawsuits in elections. So Kennedy added a sentence in his opinion that said, "Our decision is limited to the present circumstances." In other words, the only beneficiary of this principle was George W. Bush. We're not going to give this right to anyone else. We're just going to give it to Bush, which was a complete repudiation of what courts, based on precedents, are supposed to do. But, you know, when you got the votes, you got the votes. And that's how the election ended.
Now, you write that David Souter seriously considered resigning after Bush v. Gore. How come?
See, this was the biggest surprise to me in writing The Nine, because Souter is such a peculiar and unique figure on the court because he's so different from the others. I mean, as most people know, he's the only bachelor justice. He's never been married. He lives this very ascetic lifestyle. He eats an apple and a cup of yogurt for lunch every day. When he arrived at the court, he'd never heard of this drink that some of the other justices drink called Diet Coke. he just leads this very ascetic life. But he takes the court very seriously, and you know he believes that judges should be divorced from politics, and he has really been divorced from politics for a long time. He saw Bush v. Gore as such a repudiation of the role of the judge. He thought the majority was so nakedly political, and frankly, he didn't like living in Washington much anyway and still doesn't, that he seriously considered resigning, and he almost did. Yet one of the even more oddities of his story is one reason why he didn't resign is because of the rule of 80. The rule of 80 says you get to resign with a full pension, with full salary as a federal judge, if the years of your service plus your age equal 80, like 65 years old plus 15 years on the bench. He wasn't eligible for his full retirement until 2004. So he's such a frugal New Englander that, you know what, the hanging around for the pension seemed like the retiring at full salary seemed like a good idea too. So, you know, for such reasons, large decisions are made.
One of the things you certainly couldn't possibly have known in 2002 when you wrote your book on Bush v. Gore and the Florida recount was that one of the lawyers involved with the Republicans for the Florida recount would later become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. So tell us a little bit, have you learned more about his role in the Florida recount?
I did. And, you know, John Roberts has led a completely charmed life. And, you know, he was known as a Republican lawyer. He was Deputy Solicitor General under Ken Starr in the first Bush administration, but he never really spoke out much publicly. And like a lot of the top lawyers in Republican lawyers in Washington, he pitched in the recount, and he played a very important but behind-the-scenes role. He went down to Tallahassee after the first Florida Supreme Court decision, which Gore's side won. And one of the debates that the Republicans were having is, should we even apply for cert? You know, go ask the Supreme Court to hear this case, because, you know, this is basically a state issue. It was an interpretation of Florida law, the Florida Constitution. Will the justices want this case? And John Roberts, sitting around the conference room in Tallahassee, said to his colleagues, go for cert. The justices will take this case. This is too important for them to say no. And unlike many of his colleagues, Roberts was right. The justices did take the case. Now, the interesting historical question is, well, why didn't Roberts stay with it? Well, Roberts actually had to go back to Washington because he had a Supreme Court argument in a completely separate case. So that was his only contribution, but it was a significant one because not everyone agreed with him, but he was right.
Did you think it was at all inappropriate to appoint a Supreme Court justice who helped give the president his victory?
Not really. You know, I mean, he was a lawyer helping with a client. Ted Olson was obviously the main lawyer, mm-hmm. and he was appointed Solicitor General. You know, George Bush has been very good for rewarding the people who were with him from the beginning, and I don't really think that there's anything inappropriate about that.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's legal correspondent for CNN. He writes for The New Yorker, and now he has a new book called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Now, as I said before, you write a lot about Sandra Day O'Connor and about her style as the swing vote in the Rehnquist court. How would you describe that style?
O'Connor's style was more political than legal, and her political instincts were unerring for the center of American public opinion. She supported the right to choose abortion, but with restrictions like parental consent laws. She supported affirmative action, but with strict limits on quotas and the degree of affirmative action. She had this unerring sense that was not necessarily dictated by the Constitution, and it drove Antonin Scalia crazy that O'Connor came to these compromise positions sort of outside any larger judicial framework. But one reason why O'Connor was so successful as a justice is that she was able to occupy that center ground and control the outcome of important decision after important decision.
And one decision that she controlled in some ways was the challenge to the Pennsylvania state law limiting a woman's right to abortion, and the law was challenged in the Supreme Court. What did she add to that decision?
Well, this is where, you know, the historical ironies are so great, because there was one part of the Pennsylvania law that really offended her. This was relatively early in her career. This case was from 1992, and Pennsylvania passed a law that restricted abortion in various ways. But the one part that really got under O'Connor's skin was married women who sought abortions had to inform their husbands first before they got an abortion. And if there's one thing O'Connor couldn't stand, it was paternalism towards women. And that part of the law had been supported by one judge on the three-judge panel on the Third Circuit. Now, who was that one judge? Young Samuel Alito, who had just been appointed to the Third Circuit. And O'Connor was horrified by that part of the decision. So when Justice Souter, Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor got together to write their opinion in the Casey decision, which would support a woman's right to choose, O'Connor took the part, just tearing apart Alito's argument and saying it was paternalism, it was outrageous, and it was unfair. And that is really one of her most significant moments as a justice, and who, of course, becomes her replacement, but Samuel Alito.
What does she have to say about that?
Well, in public, Justice O'Connor is a very politic person, but the story of her last years on the bench is really an extraordinary personal and political tragedy, because O'Connor became so alienated from the Bush administration about the war on terror, about the war on Iraq, about extremism in all sorts of areas, that she really grew to detest President Bush. But she had a personal tragedy. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease, and O'Connor believed that she had to leave the court to take care of her husband. And even though she was 75 years old and in perfect health and at the peak of her powers, she said, "I'm not outsourcing this. I'm going to leave." So it meant giving her seat to the president she had come to disdain. And not only that, who winds up taking her place but Samuel Alito, the judge that she had almost defined her career by repudiating, which was bad enough. But the worst of all is that after the extended time it took for her to leave the bench, because if you recall, first John Roberts was nominated for her seat, then Rehnquist died, then it was the Harriet Myers fiasco, and then it was finally Samuel Alito. During that period, her husband's health deteriorated to such a point that he was really beyond her help. So here she is. She's given up her seat on the court. She's turned it over to a president and a justice that she doesn't like, all to help a husband who is now beyond her help. I mean, it's really a tragic story.
Do you think that if she knew that that would be the outcome, that she would have stayed on the court?
One of the things about Justice O'Connor is she's not big on looking back and she's not big on regrets. One thing you'll never get O'Connor to say, including about Bush v. Gore, is, I was wrong. And she's not going to say, I was wrong to leave the court. And I'd certainly never heard her say it in public or any other place. But in her heart, my guess is she does regret a lot of this.
When you say that Sandra Day O'Connor came to detest the Bush presidency, is that based on conversations with her?
You know, I haven't talked about what the basis of my reporting is, but you're just going to have to trust me on it.
Jeffrey Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book about the Supreme Court is called The Nine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From TIAA CREF, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
New York Times business reporter David Barboza thought he might be detained for pursuing a story in China, but he never expected to be held hostage in a toy factory. Coming up, he tells us what happened in China while reporting on toys recalled because of lead paint. Also, Jeffrey Toobin on the new balance of power in the Supreme Court. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Toobin, author of the new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. It's based on interviews with the justices and their law clerks. Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Part of his book is about the new balance of power in the Supreme Court and what he describes as the conservative counter-revolution. For a long time, Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote on the court, and now it's Justice Kennedy. How do they compare as swing votes?
They're very different. Justice O'Connor was very practical, very narrow in her decisions. Justice Kennedy is a very expansive person, given to flights of rhetoric that O'Connor never would. He also has a very romantic conception of the judge, One of the many peculiarities about Justice Kennedy is that in some respects he appeared like a very provincial man. When he was nominated to the Supreme Court in 1987, he still lived in the house in Sacramento where he grew up. But he had this tremendous wanderlust at the same time. And the touchstone of his career as a justice has been traveling around the world talking to other justices and talking about the Guild of Judges, and he's been very influenced by foreign judges on certain issues, like the death penalty, like gay rights, where he has moved significantly to the left. But on most issues, he remains the Republican Ed Meese protege that he was in California, and he is a more conservative justice than O'Connor was, and the fact that these so many decisions are now in his hands as opposed to O'Connor's hands, as we saw in the term that ended in June, this is a much more conservative court than it was just 2 years ago.
Well, let's compare Kennedy's role in the latest abortion decision. Sandra Day O'Connor supported the right to have an abortion, although she also supported certain restrictions on it. In the latest abortion decision, Kennedy wrote an opinion that said, "While we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon, it seems unexceptionable to conclude some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained." Would you discuss that line and its importance in the latest abortion decision?
Just a remarkable transformation. In 2000, the Supreme Court examined a late-term partial birth abortion law, whatever term you want to use, from Nebraska. And by a 5-4 vote with O'Connor in the majority, they rejected the law. They said it was a violation of a woman's right to choose. 7 years later, Congress, in almost total defiance of the court, says, we're going to pass virtually the same law. But because Alito and Roberts are now on the court and O'Connor's gone, that decision is in effect overruled. And Kennedy writes this opinion with this extraordinarily paternalistic statement that, well, you know, the reason we're banning abortion, these late-term abortions, is that you silly women come to regret it anyway. And this is exactly the kind of thing that drove O'Connor crazy, but it is part of Kennedy's conception of himself as sort of a wise lawgiver, that he will pat women on the head and say, look, you know, this is really for your own good, and you'll come to appreciate it in the long term.
How would you describe the balance of power in the Supreme Court now?
John Roberts is in charge. This is his court. Roberts is emerging as one of the most strongly ideological and brilliant justices who's been on the court in many years. His opinions are beautifully written, strongly argued, and very, very conservative. The idea that he was some sort of closet moderate, the idea that he's going to change on the bench, the idea that he is somehow not exactly what he appears to be, is folly. This is a very conservative Chief Justice, and he is using his powers to make the court different from what it was before.
Give us an example of an opinion of his from the past term that you consider ideological.
There was really an extraordinary drama on the last day of the term because the court handed down several opinions, and in each one of them, the court really showed how different it was. On an antitrust case, Roberts led the court in overturning a precedent from 1896 that was arguably in favor of consumers over corporations. He wrote his now most famous opinion as a justice in overturning the efforts of the Louisville and Seattle school districts to use race to preserve some racial balance in schools. And in a death penalty case, he voted in that case with the minority to uphold a death sentence where there was a real strong issue about the mental status of the defendant. In all of those cases, not only did he take the conservative position, but he was walking the court back. He was changing the court's precedents to move the court to the right.
Now, you described Clarence Thomas as the most conservative member of the Rehnquist Court. Is he still the most conservative member of the court?
Clarence Thomas is not just the most conservative member of the Rehnquist Court or the Roberts Court. He's the most conservative justice to serve on the court since the 1930s. If you take what Thomas says seriously, if you read his opinions, particularly about issues like the scope of the federal government, he basically thinks that the entire work of the New Deal is unconstitutional. I mean, he really believes in a conception of the federal government that hasn't been supported by the justices since Franklin Roosevelt made his appointments to the court. You know, I went to a speech that Justice Scalia gave at a synagogue here in New York a couple of years ago, and someone asked him, what's the difference between your judicial philosophy and Justice Thomas's? I thought, a very good question. And Scalia talked for a while, and he said, look, I'm a conservative. I'm a textualist. I'm an originalist, but I'm not a nut.
Meaning and I that he that thinks was, that Thomas is one?
Well, that was certainly the implication. Uh-huh. And I mean, it was pretty amazing. I mean, Thomas is well outside the mainstream, even of the conservatives on the court.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a legal correspondent for CNN. He writes about legal issues for The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. What decisions are you looking to come out of the court in the next term?
I think the biggest is going to be about the Second Amendment. There's a case coming out of Washington, D.C., an ordinance about gun control, and the D.C. Circuit for the first time in a major court ruled that the Second Amendment, which speaks of the right to bear arms, essentially bans gun control. And that case is almost certainly going to the court this year, and I think that's going to be an example of the court using its power to limit liberal governments and to say, we interpret the Second Amendment as banning gun control. And I think that's going to be a huge decision this year. Also, the next Guantanamo cases will probably be up there, an opportunity to expand executive power. It's probably not going to be as dramatic a term as the last one with the abortion case and the school desegregation case, but the agenda items will be ticked off.
Do you expect any other justices to retire during the Bush presidency?
None voluntarily. The three most likely retirees are all on the liberal side of the court. John Paul Stevens is 87 years old. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in her mid to late 76, I believe. David Souter is 69 years old but doesn't like the job and doesn't like Washington. All three of them are likely to leave soon, but none of them want to turn their seat over to George W. Bush. But the fact that the three of them are likely to leave in the next few years just underlines the stakes of the 2008 presidential election.
And Stevens at the age of 87, I mean, that's a real wild card.
It's a real wild card, but his older brother, Bill Stevens, is still practicing law at the age of 90 in Florida, so who knows? And you know, if you look at Justice Stevens, you talk to Justice Stevens, the guy is in remarkable health. He's at the top of his game. He's an active participant in oral argument. You know, I don't know if he's eating yogurt or what, but the guy, he plays tennis, he plays golf. He's got good genes.
Well, Jeffrey, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Terry.
Jeffrey Toobin is senior legal analyst for CNN and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book about the Supreme Court is called The Nine. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our interviews. Coming up, a New York Times reporter held hostage in a Chinese toy factory while investigating toys made with lead paint. This is Fresh Air. Here's a New York Times headline that caught our eye a few weeks ago. My time as a hostage, and I'm a business reporter. Well, that business reporter is my guest, David Barboza. He covers China for The Times. He was visiting a Chinese factory complex, trying to interview the manufacturer of a toy that had been recalled because of lead paint. But instead of getting the interview, he was accused of being a spy and was held hostage for 9 hours, along with a photographer and translator. Barboza has been covering stories related to the tainted goods that have been exported from China, including toxic toys and pet food. He's also contributing to The Times' ongoing series called China Choking on Growth. I spoke with him during his current visit to the U.S. Barboza says one of the many reasons he was surprised to be held hostage is that he'd become used to being treated like a dignitary when he visited Chinese factories.
I think that's just generally the culture in China, that when foreigners come for interviews, and many of the times I was treated as a dignitary, these are state-owned companies. And state-owned companies kind of operate a little like the state. So as if I'm going in and meeting Hu Jintao or, you know, the president or the prime minister, they sit you in this big room and they bring out tea and there's a lot of welcoming remarks, and it's a long time before you actually get to an interview. That's a lot more welcoming than someone going and writing about political matters for business. The Chinese want to do business with Americans, with Europeans, and so they want to welcome the foreign media who's writing about business. It was very easy for me to get a visa, a journalist visa in China, and I think that's one of the reasons.
So what were you investigating when you were held hostage in the toy factory?
I had gotten a call a day before asking if I would go to a toy factory in southern China, in Dongguan, I believe it was. And I was supposed to be investigating where the lead paint came from in a toy recall case that had happened that week. There was a very popular toy called Thomas and Friends toy railway sets, and I have to admit that I had not even heard of this. I don't have children yet, but my editors had heard about this, and it was a major recall. The factories, you have to know that factories in China are all sort of guarded compounds. They are, you know, they house dormitories for the workers. They house, you know, lots of factory places, maybe a shop, and they have these iron gates that electronically slide closed. And so it's not easy to get into the factory grounds. But for some reason at this factory, all 50 of their security guards were asleep the night we showed up. We showed up, I believe, on a Sunday night after 8 o'clock. It took us that long to actually find the factory. And when we drove up to it, we were stopped by one of the guards, and they asked what we were doing. And we said, we're from the New York Times, and we're here to look at the factory. And they said, fine, just fill out this form and come on in. And so we drove in. I had myself, a translator, and a photographer, and we went into this big open area where lots of workers were milling around. And this is really like a college campus. I mean, a lot of these factories have people who are generally age 18 to 24, mostly women, and it looks like a college campus. So we drove into the basketball court, started interviewing people on the basketball court. You know, there were lots of security guards around, and we luckily found some of the people that worked in paint supply after about 5 minutes in this factory complex. So it was sort of very fortunate that we were able to get in so easily and interview people, and we weren't violating any rules because we had signed in, and we had actually, out in the open, were photographing and interviewing people, and we were a little surprised that no one stopped us, but, you know, we kept going.
So did you find out anything about the use of lead paint in this factory before you were accused of being a spy?
At the end of those interviews, we only knew where the paint was going, where the painting was taking place in that big complex. And we knew what the workers made, how much they earned, how long the hours were. We got a good sense of the factory, but we didn't, you know, solve our main question, which was, is lead paint being intentionally applied to these toys?
Okay, so you left the factory on Sunday. It was the following day that the security guards decided to detain you. Why? What happened on Monday that made them suspicious of you when you returned?
I think when we started taking photographs and trying to interview workers, they got very suspicious, and the managers really didn't know what was going on. And so they called one of the factory bosses in and set us up in a room for about an hour. And what I realized afterwards was that they were trying to figure out what to do with us. And when we decided we had been in that room for too long and that we were leaving, they then, the manager or the boss of this factory actually arrived and talked to us and actually gave us a hard time for coming onto the factory grounds and said we had broken the law by entering the factory. And I said, no, we had signed in. And he decided that he was going to take us to his little villa and have a discussion with us. And then he was going to give us a tour of this factory. But in fact, he was detaining us. And he would detain us for the next 9 hours because he believed we had broken into his factory. We had done things illegally by taking photographs of his workplace. And I think he was determined to get those photographs and to figure out whether we were actually spies.
How did you get out?
Well, we negotiated for hours. And if you've been to China, you know that negotiation is everything. There's negotiation over buying things on the streets, on getting a taxi. And we had to negotiate with government officials who were called in. And in fact, we called the police and the government in to try to rescue us from the factory because the factory claimed it was calling the police and the government, but it wasn't. And so when the government officials eventually came, following the police officials, they also had to negotiate with this factory to get our release. And it was only after 3 or 4 hours of negotiation where I conceded that I would write one sentence that they agreed to sort of let us go.
What was the sentence?
The sentence was something like, I agree that it is not true that this factory asked me to come and visit them and take photographs. Something to that effect, that basically they did not know we were going to be visiting the factory and taking photographs.
And that's true. They didn't know.
They didn't. So I felt that it was fine for me to do that. And if that's all it would take for me to get out of here after 6 or 7 hours, I was willing to write that sentence. But I was also very nervous about what I would write down and whether I would start writing, because pretty soon maybe they would request that I write other things. And in fact, they did.
And?
And I was so frustrated, I just said to them, look, I am being held hostage. I am not writing anything. This is not a torture session. I wrote the sentence that you wanted. I am not writing anything any longer.
And they let you go?
They didn't. They debated it. They faxed this letter to some other factory bosses who were out of town. And then after more and more negotiation, they agreed to send us to the police station to write a written statement of what happened that day. And then after writing that statement at something like 1 or 2 in the morning, after the New York Times editors called me and I told them that we're going to complain to the U.S. Embassy, then they started to believe that they had to let us go, and they released us that night.
In this whole experience, what did you learn about the power structure in China and the relationship of the factory bosses to the government, to the police?
You know, while this was taking place, I really didn't think of this in any terms of a story. I thought this is just one of the hassles that takes place in China as you're trying to pursue a story. But later on, I realized that this is really a window into the power structure in China, that when the police arrived at that factory, they had absolutely no power. And they talked to the factory bosses about letting us go, and the factory bosses said no. And then another line of police came, and they were told no. And they listened to both sides, and they had nothing to do. And then when the government came, the government couldn't release us from that factory. It was only after hours of negotiation and compromise that we could get out. So I think I realized that something I'd been seeing all along in China for the last couple of years is that the government really doesn't have total control over local officials and factory officials, that there is a very complex set of negotiations that needs to take place and a hierarchy to the regional areas and the factory areas. And I had to understand that, and that was at the heart of this situation, that the government and whoever's interest was in place there had to find a way to negotiate it.
My guest is David Barboza. He covers business and culture in China for the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Barboza, and he's the New York Times Shanghai business and cultural correspondent. He's in the United States on a brief visit. So let's look at some of the larger problems in China now in terms of the manufacturing. I mean, as you write, China accounts for 95% of all the toy recalls so far this year. And many of those recalls are because of lead paint. And, you know, you've very recently written about lead paint problems in China. Why is there so much lead paint in China? I mean, do the people behind it know what kind of problems, you know, how toxic lead paint is?
I think in some cases they know, in some cases they don't know. But to understand that story, you have to understand that China is growing at a blistering pace, and everyone is setting up factories and making deals. And also, many of these factories are trying to come in with low costs so that they can please the big corporations of America or Europe, the big retailers. And often those American and European companies go to these factories and say, we will make a deal with you to buy so many products next year, but you have to cut prices. This is what we want to see you come in at. And so in this big scramble to set up the factories, to meet the requirements, to please the retailers, to lower the cost, a lot of factory owners are cutting corners. They don't always know the consequences of cutting these corners, but it's rampant through China. This is really not a new story. There's counterfeiting all across China, and there's cutting of corners and putting in ingredients that aren't supposed to be there.
Let's get to the pet food recalls. There was a substance called melamine that was in a lot of the pet food. Like, what is that substance, and what's your understanding of why it had been in so much of the pet food that was exported?
Right. Well, melamine is a little like urea, and going way back in the United States, actually, agricultural farmers used to occasionally put urea and some of these high-protein sort of ingredients into their food supply to sort of boost the protein count. And I don't know how they came up with melamine. I mean, melamine actually comes originally from coal in China, and it's an industrial chemical. But someone in China realized that melamine was very much like urea, and people didn't test for it, and it did the same thing that urea had done in the United States in the 1920s and 30s. It would send the protein count higher. And so, in other words, you would think that you're getting high-protein corn or high-protein meal, but actually they would put in very low-protein corn or meal. But it would seem, because of the small bit of melamine, to be very strong in protein. And so when someone figured this out, they started putting it in pet food ingredients.
And do you think the people behind that knew how toxic the melamine could be?
I don't. Basically, I think the companies using melamine didn't realize that melamine, when it mixes with other like chemicals, can create a sort of toxic potion. And that's only what scientists found out later. So when they did this mixture, maybe by accident, they created something that was really potent. And when that got into the pet food, that created the problem.
How does this affect you as a consumer when you're in the United States buying cheap products that you know are manufactured in China?
Well, I'm actually trying not to buy many of those cheap products. I mean, not really that intentionally that I'm trying to send a message, but I just think that you have to think twice about some of these goods. Whether there's just, if you visit many factories, you'll just see how big the production is. It's sort of like when I've gone to, slaughterhouses, and I have to think twice about eating pork. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to see how much material is coming through the factory, how much chemical waste there is in these factories, the toxic fumes, the conditions. So you kind of almost feel after you've visited a lot of these factories that maybe you don't want to consume so much. Maybe there's too much consumption going on in the world. And maybe people are demanding prices that are too low, that they cannot comply with the laws in China. And one of the thoughts that I have in visiting these factories is, nothing is free. And if you're not paying on this side of the ocean, someone is paying in China. If they're not complying with environmental regulations or labor regulations, they're eventually going to pay as far as health costs and environmental costs and other things. So I think visiting factories or visiting China makes you think differently about being a consumer.
David Barboza, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Glad to be with you.
David Barboza writes about business and culture in China for the New York Times and is contributing to the Times series about China, Choking on Growth. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade by Diana Gabaldon, author of the Outlander novels, and from Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What happens in Pakistan's upcoming presidential election will not only affect that country, it will affect America's war on terrorism. On the next Fresh Air, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid returns to talk about the latest political developments in his country. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.